This is VOA News via remote. I'm Marissa Melton. In an extraordinary phone call on Saturday, U.S. President Donald Trump pleaded with the election officials in the southern U.S. state of Georgia to find him enough votes to overturn his pivotal loss there to President-elect Joe Biden. Trump spoke with the state's top elections official, Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, in a recording obtained by The Washington Post and published Sunday afternoon. In an hour-long call, Mr. Trump disputed the accuracy of three separate vote counts in Georgia that showed Biden was the first Democratic presidential contender to capture the state since 1992. On Sunday, Mr. Trump said on Twitter, "I spoke to Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger yesterday about Fulton County and voter fraud in Georgia. He was unwilling or unable to answer questions such as the ballots under the table scam, ballot destruction, out-of-state voters, dead voters, and more. He has no clue." That's the end of the tweet. A few hours later, Raffensperger replied, also via Twitter, "Respectfully, President Trump, what you're saying is not true. The truth will come out." Even if Trump were to upend the Georgia vote, Biden would still have more than the 270-vote majority needed to win the presidency in the Electoral College. Thousands of Iraqis converged on central Baghdad's Tahrir Square on Sunday to mark the first anniversary of the twin assassinations in a U.S. airstrike of a top Iranian general and the leader of a powerful Iraqi Shiite militia. Last year's U.S. drone strike near Baghdad airport killed Major General Qasem Soleimani, the commander of the elite Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas, the deputy head of Iraq's Hashd al-Shaabi militia, along with several other Iran-allied militiamen. More on that story at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News. Authorities in southwestern Pakistan said Sunday that gunmen had kidnapped and killed 11 coal mine workers. The deadly overnight attack took place in the town of Mach in Baluchistan province, 50 kilometers southeast of Quetta, the provincial capital. Local officials confirmed that several miners were also seriously injured and were being treated in a local hospital. A post-attack mobile video viewed by VOA showed the slain workers blindfolded with their hands tied behind their backs. The victims were said to be members of the minority Hazara Shiite community, which has come under attack from extremists in the past. India has granted emergency authorization to two vaccines for COVID-19, setting the stage for rolling out what could be the world's largest immunization program. The two vaccines are the British-developed AstraZeneca vaccine that's being produced in India and another developed by an Indian pharmaceutical company, Bharat Biotech. India's approval of the AstraZeneca vaccine comes within days of approval granted by Britain. An Indian company, the Serum Institute of India, has already stockpiled 50 million doses of the vaccine that it made even before formal approvals had come. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi tweeted, quote, "It would make every Indian proud that the two vaccines that have been given emergency use approval are made in India." India, the world's second-worst hit nation, has had the ambitious target of immunizing 300 million people by August. These will include healthcare workers, security personnel, those over 50 years of age, and the clinically vulnerable. Reaching that goal will involve administering 600 million doses, as each vaccine requires two doses to be effective. Rescue workers have uncovered a seventh body from a landslide that buried homes in the village of Ask near Norway's capital, police said on Sunday, but hopes persist that three people who remain missing might yet be found alive. A police spokesman told reporters the search is still considered a rescue mission, in his words, quote, "until we decide otherwise." Police said the latest body was found near where two others had been recovered, but they gave no further details. Seven bodies have now been found in the wreckage. Two of them were children. 10 people were also injured in the landslide, one seriously. The landslide happened early Wednesday last week in the village of Ask, again 25 kilometers northeast of Oslo. About 1,000 of the people's, the town's population of 5,000 have been evacuated because of fears for their safety and the safety of their homes as the land continues to move. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton from Washington. You're listening to VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, January 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Niger authorities now say 100 people were killed in Saturday attacks on two villages.
So far, there's not any group that has claimed responsibility for the attack, but these are areas that have been attacked by Islamic militants, especially in the areas of Mali and Niger borders.
Sudan arrested two health officials for illegal burial of 2019 protest victims. Cameroon trucks are not traveling to Central African Republic following pre-election violence there. And COVID-19 curfew has been extended in Kenya as schools there reopen today, Monday.
The president has this morning issued an executive order extending some of the containment measures to ensure that the ecosystem within which our children are going back to school.
And Cameroon separatists have vowed to stop next week's African Soccer Champions Cup tournament from taking place in English-speaking Cameroon. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Niger authorities now say 100 people were killed in Saturday's attacks on two villages. Security sources had originally said that at least 70 civilians had been killed, but Reuters reported Sunday that Prime Minister Brigi Rafini announced the new number in a national television broadcast on Sunday following a visit to the areas of the attacks. VOA's Hausa service reporter Mark Mon Lalo, who has been covering Niger's December 27 election, is in the Nigerian capital, Niamey.
So far, the government has not said anything in respect of the attacks. When VOA called government spokesperson Zakaria Abdulrahman, he said he's trying to gather enough information before talking to newsmen. However, a resident in the area where the attack took place, who doesn't want his name mentioned for security reasons, said the Predon attack on Saturday killed 67 people in the villages of Chombangu and Zoramudare. These victims, according to sources, include women and children, and their corpses are still lying in a hospital in a town called Banibongu, which is not far from where the attacks happened.
Has anyone claimed responsibility for the attack?
So far, there's not any group that has claimed responsibility for the attack, but these are areas that have been attacked by Islamic militants, especially in the areas of Mali and Niger borders.
What do you make of the fact that these attacks are coming right after the Nigerian election? Could it be that the militants are not pleased with the outcome of the presidential election?
According to sources, these attacks have nothing to do with the outcome of the election. What we learned is that it is a reprisal attack launched by the gunmen who claimed that two of their members were killed by a vigilante group which patrols the district, which is in the southwestern region of Niger that shares border with Mali. However, the attack drive home what people have been clamoring for when they went to polls on Sunday, where many voters say they want a leader that will bring an end to these incessant attacks in the country, especially in the border areas with Mali and Nigeria.
Talking about the election, so there will be runoff in February. What are the dynamics for the runoff? In other words, what should we expect in the runoff?
So what we will be seeing in the coming weeks, if not days, are a lot of politicking, talks of alliance, going back to the drawing boards to strategize on both sides of the divide. It is crystal clear to all that no party can single-handedly win the election, whether in the first or second round. So I wouldn't be surprised if the two major candidates are now knocking on the doors of different political parties for possible coalition, which of course will come at a price, since these smaller parties will also have their own demands before they agree on any alliance.
Mahmoud, thank you very much. It has been a pleasure speaking with you always on Daybreak Africa. Thank you.
My pleasure, James.
That was VOA's Hausa service reporter Mark Mon Lalo speaking with us from the Nigerian capital, Niamey. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has extended the nationwide nighttime curfew and several other COVID-19 measures, saying it will guarantee the safety of students as schools there reopen today, Monday. They had been closed since March last year due to the pandemic. In an executive order read by the Cabinet Secretary for Interior, President Kenyatta said the measures will remain in place until March 12. Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi.
The announcement to extend the curfew was made during a news conference held on Sunday by a team comprising the Cabinet Secretaries of Interior, Education, Health and ICT, among other stakeholders, announcing that all plans were in place to ensure a smooth reopening of schools after nearly a year. President Uhuru Kenyatta, through an executive order delivered by the Cabinet Secretary for Interior, Fred Matiang'i, said the nationwide curfew will ensure a smooth reopening of schools and will also continue to be enforced between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. daily for 60 more days. The Cabinet Secretary added that the order also extends other COVID-19 containment measures, including ban on all political meetings, as well as mandatory wearing of face masks in public places.
Excellency, the President has this morning issued an executive order extending some of the containment measures to ensure that the ecosystem within which our children are going back to school remains manageable and remains constant and safeguards the health of our children as he pledged in his New Year message. So His Excellency the President has extended the curfew days. He has extended several of the containment measures.
Education Cabinet Secretary Professor George Magoha said that despite the challenges posed by the COVID-19 pandemic, students must report to school today, Monday. He acknowledged that it will not be possible to achieve the required 1 meter social distancing in classrooms and urged teachers to be creative by conducting their classes under trees in dining halls and any other open space.
I want to affirm very strongly that the government of the Republic of Kenya has done everything possible to ensure that our schools are ready for reopening. Where you people are going to make a lot of noise is the issue of social distancing. And we have said this will remain a challenge, but it shall not stop us from opening our schools. We shall open our schools. We have said that the teachers should be innovative. Gallant teachers being innovative, it means every open space in the school, the dining hall, the assembly hall, the school auditorium, can be used as classrooms, including open spaces. By the way, most people don't know that learning under a tree is extremely healthy.
However, Benson Adika, a primary school teacher in Nairobi, says he's worried about his safety because during the partial reopening, they were dealing with a fraction of the students. But now that the whole school is resuming, he's scared the virus might spread.
I'm worried because, you know, we're just having a portion of our total entire population. But tomorrow, we are having almost everybody back to school. So to some extent, I also fear that it might crop up again and we'll be in that position. And then the social distance will be a challenge. I may say that all cannot be well as it were maybe in the past few months.
More than 14 million learners are expected to report back to school today, Monday, after more than 8 months of closure occasioned by the pandemic. However, according to the Kenya Private Schools Association, 56,000 students from private schools will have to seek readmission in public schools as more than 339 private schools have permanently closed down due to the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
Sudan's public prosecutor announced over the weekend that it had arrested the former director of the country's Forensic Medicine Authority and suspended the director of the Omdurman morgue for the illegal burial of the victims of the attack on pro-democracy protesters in June 2019. In another development, Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok announced last Friday that his government has approved the ratification of the International Treaty Against Torture. Former Sudanese diplomat Khalil Moussa says Hisham Zain Al-Abedin and Jamal Youssef were arrested for illegal burial and also because investigators are about to publish their findings into the investigation of the 2019 killings.
Actually, the prosecutor general arrested two medical officers. One is the director of the Forensic Medical, or as we call it in Sudan, Medical Justice Department. And the second is the director of Omdurman Hospital Mortuary. And that they had conducted illegal procedures to bury some deceased of the protesters. during the uprising and the revolution in front of the headquarters of the army, that because they didn't follow up properly the procedures to tackle the body of these deceased and these victims without having enough investigation according to the penal code procedures to notify the authority and to follow the legal rules for that. Legally, the doctors are not personally authorized to bury any deceased having death by violence unless there is a criminal investigation by the police department.
What do you think this means? Because there were rumors at the time that perhaps these people were buried, as you mentioned, illegally, but there were some speculations on social media that there was some speculation that there was a sale of unidentified bodies to be used in the training of medical students. Is this what could be behind the decision to arrest them?
So I think this is one of the motivation, one of the reasons that why the med officer Damal, the director of mortuary of an hospital, was arrested. But this because the National Commission for Investigation of the death of the protesters is about to conclude its final report that led by the prominent lawyer Nadin Adi, and he declared like 1 week ago he's about to conclude and submit his full report to the Prime Minister in order to open the legal procedures and to bring all these perpetrators to justice. So it is for two reasons. One, it is about the conclusion of the commission report on investigation of the death of the protesters. Second, also the misconduct of the medical officer regarding the death report of one of the victims that took place 1 week ago.
What do you make of this announcement by Prime Minister Hamdok that Sudan is ready to ratify the international treaty against torture?
I think one of the very important points for Sudan ratification for this international convention, this should stop any kind of torture against normal citizen, against any citizen, and to preserve and to honor it is constitutional right for any citizen to be protected from torture. And this is also will bring Sudan closer to the international community, will bring Sudan closer to the international standard norms of human rights. And I think it is well received and welcomed by the Sudanese public opinion. But ratification alone is not enough. The second step should be taken by the government is to amend all the national laws in Sudan in order to match and to be consistent with the International Convention Against Torture.
Khalil Moussa is the former Sudanese diplomat. He was speaking with us from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, January 4th. Hundreds of trucks are parked in Cameroon because drivers have stopped shipping goods and humanitarian assistance into the troubled Central African Republic in the face of violence following that country's December 27 election violence. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Ajaizo Bukar, a 51-year-old Central African Republic truck driver, says he has been in the eastern Cameroon town of Garoua-Boulaye impatiently waiting for the security situation in his country to improve. He says several hundred CAR and Cameroonian truck drivers cannot cross to the CAR capital Bangui because of fighting between CAR government troops and rebels.
Nous sommes au niveau de la sous-préfecture de Garoua-Boulaye. La situation est bloquée.
He says for about 2 weeks now, at least 700 trucks have been unable to enter the CAR from the eastern Cameroonian border town of Garoua-Boulaye. He says drivers are parking their trucks wherever they find space that is safe from thieves. He says some drivers and their assistants lack drinking water, food, and toilets. Bukar said most of them are transporting humanitarian assistance, food, and other goods from Cameroon's coastal city of Douala. The CAR government says violence was reported in several parts of the country before, during, and after the December 27 presidential elections. The CAR had accused former President François Bozize of organizing a rebel alliance to disrupt the general election. Bozize's candidacy for president was rejected, and he is accused of organizing rebel attacks, asking for the vote to be postponed until peace and security is restored. On December 25, Cameroon said more than 80 CAR troops crossed into Cameroon when fighting intensified there. Cameroon said its military pushed back an attempt by CAR rebels to enter its eastern territory. Buka says the fighting has completely disrupted his business.
Responsable syndicaux a essayé de faire maximum possible, mais c'est insuffisant.
He says they have so far received food, aid, and water from the Association of Cameroon and CAR truck drivers, but that the assistance is not enough. He says they are pleading with the Cameroonian government to help the drivers because the situation in CAR is getting worse and no one knows when the fighting will be over. A crisis meeting of truck drivers, the military and Cameroonian authorities was held Saturday, January 2, to find ways to help the drivers. Moïse Vokeng, president of the Cameroon Professional Transporters Network Association, says they have ordered their trucks not to enter the CAR until peace returns. He spoke via a messaging app from Douala.
We have first of all decided to stop moving trucks towards the Central African Republic due to that war there. You know, within 2 or 3 weeks, our drivers are abandoned, sleeping under the trucks, and the situation is very sad. So we are now expecting that with the collaboration of the custom here in Cameroon, we'll find spaces such as Bolloré Park at Belabo to offload and at least liberate some lorries and the workers who are suffering so much.
Cameroon said it provided space in border towns for the shippers to store goods until the situation in the CAR improves. Cameroon also said its military was keeping watch on its eastern border with the CAR. Vokeng pleaded with the United Nations Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission in the Central African Republic, also called MINUSCA, to help protect drivers transporting humanitarian and perishable goods from Garoua-Boulaye to Bangui. The Central African Republic depends on the Douala seaport for about 95% of its goods and humanitarian aid. Much of the election material printed in Europe was brought into the landlocked country through Cameroon. MINUSCA forces protected some of the material and election observers when they traveled from Garoua-Boulaye to Bangui when rebels threatened to stop the polls. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
A spokesperson for the self-proclaimed Republic of Ambazonia says the group will stop next week's African Soccer Nations Cup tournament from taking place in the English-speaking region of the country because the separatists cannot guarantee the security of the athletes. The African Nations Soccer Championship is scheduled to take place from January 16 to February 7th. Chris Anu, the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Republic of Ambazonia, says the people of the English-speaking regions are more concerned about liberty than soccer.
Cameroon and Ambazonia have been at war for 4 years and counting. And for those number of years, children in Ambazonia have not been to school. And La République du Cameroun seem not to care about it. All that they care about is bringing some African countries to come to Ambazonia to stage an African Champions Cup. We have said no to it because, number one, we cannot guarantee them security. And we will fight every one of them with the last breath and the last machine that we have. We have written to the African nations concerned and to the international bodies telling them we in Ambazonia will not allow that thing to take place in Ambazonia because it's a mockery of the people, the close to 15,000 people who have been killed in our territory.
As you know, Chris, the people of Cameroon and Ambazonia, I'm sure they love soccer. You will be depriving them of the opportunity. Are you not concerned?
No, I think our people are more interested about life and liberty, their freedoms, than some football thing that lasts for 1 week. And by the way, if African countries are so interested in having Cameroon stage this competition, where have the African countries been with war going on in this country for over 4 years? The African Union has said nothing. They've called no meeting. They've not called the government of Cameroon to order with the slaughter and the razing of villages and towns into dust. So we have no respect for what the African Cup is all about. For as long as they sit there, fold their hands and see our people slaughtered and all they care is trying to come around to put on some football match. No, we are not depriving our people. Our people don't want to see it.
I'm sure President Paul Biya and his government are determined to have this tournament. How would you stop it?
We are going to stop this competition by any means available to us. Our restoration fighters are ready, and I can assure Cameroon, no matter the number of army they deploy on our streets in the Fako or Victoria, we will outwit them and we will stop those matches.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Republic of Ambazonia. He was speaking with us from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the first major football event on the African calendar for 2021, which is the CAF-organized CHAN 2021 tournament. Chipolopolo of Zambia kicked off their pre-total CHAN 2020 friendly series with a 3-3 draw against Niger on the 2nd of January in Yaoundé, Cameroon. Total CHAN 2020 host Cameroon are staging a four-nation friendly tournament from the 1st to the 7th of January 2021 in Yaoundé, involving fellow finalists Uganda, Niger, and Zambia. Cameroon kicked off the tournament with a 1-1 draw against Uganda. Jonathan McKinstry is the Cranes of Uganda national team coach.
We're in a tough group. You know, football from all around Africa in terms of a derby with Rwanda to begin with. Obviously, the champions, Morocco and Togo, will present, you know, a new challenge for the tournament. But, you know, we go in confident. We think we've got a really good group of players, young, energetic, and yeah, for us it's about going out and showcasing the best that we have, and we believe if we do ourselves justice that we can go deep into the tournament.
Action will resume later today with Zambia playing Uganda, and later Cameroon will face Niger. Total CHAN 2020 will kick off on the 16th of January 2021 in Yaoundé, when Cameroon will face Zimbabwe in the opening match. And now to Southern Africa. After winning the COSAFA tournament last December in Port Elizabeth, South Africa, Mozambique Under 20 team started its preparation this week for the Total Under 20 African Cup of Nations Mauritania 2021. COSAFA Under 20 title was Mozambique's first international one, paving the way for their first ever Under 20 AFCON appearance. Mozambique coach Diaro Montero called 35 players, including 5 new faces who did not take part in the COSAFA tournament, 4 of whom played in Portugal and 1 in Spain. Elsewhere in Italy, Napoli coach Gennaro Gattuso said on Sunday he felt foolish for giving Nigerian striker Victor Osimhen permission to travel home to Nigeria for Christmas, with a forward testing positive for coronavirus on his return. Victor Osimhen joined Napoli for a club record fee of up to $94.6 million last summer, but has not played since November 8th because of a shoulder injury. Victor Osimhen faces club sanctions after images of him partying without wearing a mask were shared on social media. But manager Gattuso said he also felt embarrassed for giving the 22-year-old permission to return to Africa. In chess news, Elizabeth Cassidy, a 9-year-old Kenyan student, has qualified for the World Youth Chess Championship to be held in Greece. The event will be held between May the 2nd to May the 11th. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, January 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you will have a great week.